This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. You step inside and you and I get the information we need on the big issues from people who know what they're talking about. Do please tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And if you'd like, please recommend us to your friends, families and entire neighbourhoods. Thanks to those of you who've recently reviewed us, including Vite Vujagig, Trofimov Anglais and Pete Midge. If you enjoy this, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room. For example, you might want to listen to the last programme we did about ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, in February last year. Because this week, I'm getting briefed on ISIS again. I'll be asking what should be done with all the foreigners who went to Syria to fight. So take your seat in The Briefing Room.
They turned their back on Britain when they left Britain to cause the destruction and commit their hateful crimes. We believe that justice should be done locally and they're no longer part of Britain. The British people do not want to see them returned.
The they, in the Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson's answer to questions yesterday, were Alexander Cote and Al-Shafi El-Sheikh, young men from Britain suspected of having committed brutal crimes in Syria, including murders of British citizens, on behalf of the so-called Islamic State. It was reported this week that they're alive and being held by Kurdish forces. So today, I'm getting briefed on what happens to these men next, how many more there are like them still out there or who have returned home, and what kind of threat they are. Step inside the briefing room to find out. We'll start with the legal status of Alexander Cote and El-Shafi El-Sheikh, men who grew up in London but now appear to have been stripped of their British citizenship. I was joined earlier in the briefing room by Fiona de Londres, who is Professor of Global Legal Studies at Birmingham Law School. Fiona de Londres, we understand that Alexander Cote and El-Shafi El-Sheikh have had their British citizenship removed. How can this actually be done?
So under British law, it's possible for the Home Secretary to strip somebody of citizenship. There are very limited grounds, but the one that's likely to have applied here is that she would consider it conducive to the public good to do this, because the persons in question have, as the Act says, conducted themselves in a manner seriously prejudicial to the vital interests of the United Kingdom. And if that is the case, and the Home Secretary has reasonable grounds to believe that they could become a citizen of another country, then she is entitled to strip them of their citizenship.
But what about the point of them therefore effectively being stateless?
Yes, so it is now permitted, and this is a more recent change, to strip someone of their citizenship, even if it would make them stateless, although the Home Secretary should be able to say that she has these reasonable grounds to believe that they might be able to assert another nationality. And so this is where the real concern in many ways arises, because, of course, as a matter of human rights law, there would be a lot of concern about making people stateless as a principled matter.
Now, we don't know if these two particular men have any other nationalities. Why, apart from making a statement, if you like, about what kind of people they are, why would it actually be in the interests of the British authorities to render such people stateless?
In this case, it looks like these people have been captured and thus are within the detention or the control of some authority. And so here, there is, of course, the expressive part, but it may also be to ensure that the state is trying to sever any obligations that might be said that the UK has to either of these people.
Now, is there anything problematic about that? I mean, they went over there, they've been captured by people who are over there, they can be dealt with over there.
Well, can they? That's the question. We don't really know if they can be. If it is the case that they're in the custody of the Kurdish authorities, then the capacity there for holding criminal trials or even military justice proceedings is relatively low. We would have concerns if, for example, they were to be tried in Syria around due process and fair proceedings. And so it's not at all clear that they, in fact, would be in the custody of an entity that can deal with them in a way that would, let's say, be in line with the due process expectations that we would ordinarily have.
Now, presumably, that doesn't just have implications for them. It has implications, say, for the British families of British people who these people allegedly murdered, because it might actually render their chances of getting justice quite difficult.
That's right. I mean, I think that there is a concern, as you say, a justice concern here about the possibility that these people might not be tried because they might not be in a place where that is really possible. And as a result of that, that there might not be accountability.
Is it your view, from a legal perspective, that Britain is actually the most legally appropriate place to bring them?
It is, even with citizenship stripped, if that is what happened. The UK is the country of origin of both of these people. It has a functioning criminal justice system. It has high levels of sophisticated security machinery and mechanisms in order to secure a trial and secure them if they were to be convicted. There isn't an obvious place where they can be tried at present unless they're handed over to the Iraqi authorities.
To Iraq, despite the fact that they're in Syria?
Yeah, so there has been a pattern or an arrangement at times of engaging in the patriation of prisoners to the Iraqi authorities, given the geographic proximity and the fact that they have a well-functioning criminal justice system. So that is probably the most likely, although not necessarily the most appropriate course of action.
How long from precedent would that take, and what would be the likely consequences were they to be found guilty?
The timeline is very difficult to predict. What we do know is that in many cases, if found guilty, the sentence is a capital sentence.
In other words, they'd be executed.
Correct.
Fiona de Londres. Côté and El Sheikh were just two among thousands of people who made their way from all over the world to take part in the war in Syria and Iraq. How many others went, and where are they all now? My next guest in the briefing room is Richard Barrett, a former head of counter-terrorism at MI6 and currently director of the Global Strategy Network. Richard Barrett, let's just do the how many's and who's of this. How many foreign fighters went to Syria and Iraq to fight for ISIS?
Well, the overall total is estimated at around 40,000, which is a hell of a big number, of course, but from the Western countries, it's probably closer to about 5,000, I should think, you know, if we include the EU, Canada, Australia, United States.
And where does Britain sit relative to other countries?
Well, quite high. There are reportedly about 850 British subjects and residents who went to Iraq, Syria to join Islamic State or another similar group, I should say. But from Germany, slightly more, maybe around 900 to 1,000. From France, considerably more. We're probably up to about 1,900 from France. But funnily enough, the country with the most per capita contribution of foreign fighters appears to be Belgium, which has somewhere between 400 and 500 who are recorded to have gone.
And I imagine more came from some of the countries of the North Africa and neighbouring countries.
Yes, indeed. An awful lot from Tunisia, from Saudi Arabia, from Jordan, and funnily enough, from Russia as well. And of course, from Central Asian states, which used to be part of the Soviet Union.
Okay, so looking mostly, I think, and not just for parochial reasons, well, maybe for parochial reasons, that those who went from Europe and from Britain, how many of them have now made it back or are on their, or as far as we can tell, on their way back?
Well, these numbers are always rather soft, of course, when one can't get a really good idea of the precise figures. But in the United Kingdom, the authorities have been saying for some time that about half have returned. That would be somewhere over 400. In other countries, I think it's slightly less. Germany and France is slightly less. So we are slightly odd in that, in being higher. And also, I think in the United Kingdom, it's slightly odd that more returned early on. After 2014, 2015, very few seem to have come back to the United Kingdom, where people have come back to other states. It may be something to do with the reception that they got there. Maybe they were surprised at the way the Islamic State developed, whereas other countries perhaps less so. But anyway, that is the fact. And overall, I should imagine that if you're looking at the European Union, perhaps you could say on average about a third of those 4,000 to 5,000 are back at home.
And the other two thirds, what proportion of those are dead?
Well, in UK, it's estimated that 130 of those 850-odd are dead. In France, it'd be slightly more. In Germany, too.
And what proportion are now, do we think, captured by other forces in the area?
Certainly some. I mean, for UK, there's about 300 that are unaccounted for. Now, some of those may be just because the numbers are inaccurate, but they're not yet 300 captured by Syrian Democratic Forces or other groups operating there.
Of the people who've returned, what is it that we can say they have been up to, and how much of a threat do we think they have been since they arrived back?
Well, so far, I would say that the returnees haven't been so much of a threat, which is interesting, but it's also reflective, actually, of a trend of returning foreign fighters from way back, from Afghanistan, for example, from Bosnia and places like that. The returnees tend not to be always involved in terrorist planning or terrorist commission of terrorist offences. But nonetheless, when they are, they make those attacks much more lethal and in a way much more effective. So although very few in numbers are involved, nonetheless, their involvement is significant. We have to be clear about what we mean about returnees, because in the Bataclan attack, for example, in November 2015, and in the Brussels attacks in March 2016, which were by the same group, those people appear to have been sent out by the Islamic State to commit attacks, rather than returnees who then thought, well, let's carry on the fight, now we're at home. Here in United Kingdom, you could argue that Salman Abedi, who was the perpetrator of the Manchester bombing, was to some extent a returnee, but he went to Libya. He did associate in Libya, it appears, with people who were close to Islamic State. But he wasn't what we would mean as a core foreign fighter in that he went to join the Islamic State, stayed there for some time, fought for the Islamic State, and then came home for whatever reason. The other attacks here, if you look at London Bridge, for example, Kurram Butt was one of the perpetrators of that, and he did talk about going off to fight in Syria and Iraq, but he didn't actually do so. And I think this is one of the things that I'd like to say, that many of the people who didn't go, but maybe wanted to go, but couldn't get it together or were stopped or whatever, are probably more lethal than many of the people who went and came back. And that's because they still have that disappointment, not having done their bit, if you like. But also, they will not have had the sort of bucket of cold water of the reality of the Islamic State, which, of course, many people became disillusioned with and came back as a result.
So what you're saying is that, in your opinion, people who didn't go but who are highly radicalised and so on and might have wished to go are more of a threat than those who actually have returned. Now, what about the case of people who have supposedly had their citizenship revoked? From a counter-terror point of view, purely, what are the implications of stripping citizenship from people?
Yes, I think that, you know, these people don't just sort of disappear into thin air. So if you remove their citizenship, where do they go? What do they do? You know, are you just pushing the problem onto somebody else? I don't think that's particularly fair. We've got a good and robust judicial system here. We should be able to deal with people, whatever crime they've committed. It makes it very hard to deal with them. I mean, who is going to deal with them? Insofar as they've been captured in Syria, would you let the Syrians try them? Well, possibly not. You know, that could go anyway, couldn't it? So we do have a big problem. So statelessness isn't an answer, I don't think, because there isn't another alternative justice system that could deal with them. And you know, you may have people who say, well, that's all right, just line them up against the wall and shoot them. That's fine. You know, that'll be OK. But that is not how we live. And those are the values, after all, we're trying to protect from terrorism. And we shouldn't forget what we're fighting for as well as what we're fighting against.
Richard Barrett. But how might radicalised people who never made it to Syria be directly influenced by what's left of the so-called Islamic State? Dr. David Adesnik, Director of Research at the Foundation for Defence of Democracy in Washington, linked into the briefing room earlier to explain.
There's been increasing discussion recently of what's called virtual planning as a means of carrying out attacks by the Islamic State. And often, there was a lot of attacks where individuals were presumed to be so-called lone wolves. No one immediately identified connections they had to other individuals. But what we began to see over time as evidence came out was that there was a virtual planner involved, someone from ISIS, often located physically far away, perhaps in Iraq or Syria, and they were giving directions of various kinds and support of various kinds virtually. One example where we happen to know about what happened in a fair amount of detail is one that was going to be the Islamic State's first attack in India, in sort of the tech hub city of Hyderabad, where for almost a year and a half, the planners were in communication with an engineer named Mohammed Yazdani, who was going to carry out this attack. Ultimately, he was the target of surveillance and it was disrupted. And there, the directions were extremely detailed, from this is where we're going to hang the gun to this is where you should go and precisely how you should do it. Sometimes the contact goes right up until the very end. So there was an attack in Ansbach in Germany where there was, you know, chatting via phone to the very last minute to try to give encouragement and make sure the attack was carried out. Another fascinating example has to do with an Afghan who carried out an attack in Würzburg, also in Germany, with a knife and an axe. And you see how difficult sometimes it can be for the planner to manage an individual with sort of an extreme motivation, that he heard from the attacker, well, my knife and axe are ready, they're sharpened, I want to attack. And the planner was saying, well, perhaps you should think about a vehicular attack, that might be more effective. And the individual, Mr. Ahmadzai, responded, no, I don't know how to drive. And the planner said, well, perhaps you should learn how to drive. And he said, no, I think that would take too long. I don't want to do it. I want to die tonight. There's a very active extremist environment on social media, often on Twitter. And for various reasons, not just for carrying out these attacks, the Islamic State monitors those very carefully. They look for individuals who seem to have personal questions or an interest in Islamic extremism, may even convert. Some of them they identify as potential individuals who could participate in an attack. So this somewhat broader net is cast, and they find the right individuals. And they often invest quite a bit of time. They have people who are online with targets of recruitment, even several hours a day. It's a priority for them. So one of the important things to understand about virtual planners is precisely how they help the attackers. And there's a number of ways corresponding to the various stages of a potential attack. I mean, in the beginning, it can be, as we just talked about, finding the individuals who may participate, recruiting them and persuading them. Another one is connecting them with other individuals or vetting other individuals that may be sort of volunteered to participate in the attack. For example, it seems that an attack in France on a priest in Rouen, where this elderly priest was murdered, the two individuals lived hundreds of kilometers away from each other and were only put in touch by the virtual planner working that instance. There's probably been more than a dozen attacks where we know of that virtual planners played a role. There's the one with the murder of the priest. There's the Ansbach and Würzburg attacks. There's a terror trial that just happened in Sweden where Mr. Akilov was the defendant. It was a ramming attack. And in his case, it seems that the evidence that a virtual planner was involved only came out at trial. So, you know, an attack may happen, months may go by, and only those involved in law enforcement may really know this. And also, the virtual planner attacks are happening in many different locations. We've talked about France, we've talked about Germany, the US, the Garland, Texas attack a few years ago, Canada, Australia, Indonesia, India. So geographically, it's quite diverse. And, you know, an interesting question will be, as ISIS basically has lost control of its caliphate in Iraq and Syria due to the advances of the coalition and local partners, are they going to move more to this model? Will they find other places where they have enough security to carry out a more traditional hierarchical network-based attack? Or will they move more into the virtual planning? It's an open question.
David Adesnik. Though it no longer runs Mosul in Iraq and Raqqa in Syria, as we've heard, so-called Islamic State still casts a long shadow. But for how long? And if ISIS declines, who else in the jihadi world might benefit? I'm joined in the briefing room now by two experts in this field, Dr. Elizabeth Kendall of Pembroke College, Oxford, and Charlie Winter of the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation at King's College London. Elizabeth, if I could start with you. We've seen so-called Islamic State significantly pushed back in Syria and Iraq since we last discussed this with you, actually, a year ago. What's your impression of how far their power structure has been diminished, degraded, got done away with?
My impression is that their power structure has been very significantly diminished and done away with, but that's definitely not a reason to be complacent. I liken this to shattering a glass. You've got rid of the glass, you can't use it, that's good. But we still have a lot of dangerous splinters that are around and we need to find.
Charlie, do you agree broadly with that assessment?
Yeah, I do. I think that's a very good way to put it, actually.
Now, also a year ago, you came on the programme and you said that as they lost territory, one of the things we should look for was the capacity of the so-called Islamic State's propaganda structure to survive and replicate and to keep going. Since that time, what do you think you've observed?
It's been really interesting, actually, since this time last year. There's been a pretty straightforward decline in the ability that the Islamic State has had to produce official propaganda products. So I'm talking about videos and photo reports, newspapers, radio bulletins, all of that stuff. But the fact of the matter is that it is recovering. So that's something that we haven't seen for quite some time, for the Islamic State to actually accelerate its production of propaganda.
Elizabeth Kendall, does the latent capacity of Islamic State still exist to exert an appeal for young people or for women?
It certainly does. The Islamic State as a caliphate might have gone away, but as I've always said, you can kill terrorists, but you can't kill an idea. The idea is one of the perfect Islamic utopia. Just because it's been ruined at the moment doesn't mean that Islamic State can't try to explain it away using precedents of the setbacks suffered by the earliest Muslims in Muhammad's own lifetime. But it's not wholly convincing. It's much harder to argue that God's on your side when you're losing. But I think we'll see, and I expect Charlie will agree with me, increasing nostalgia. We had a great caliphate and you ruined it. And so there's still plenty to blame the West for. Lots of angry young men, alienated, looking for a sense of belonging, a group identity. None of that's going to go away.
Charlie, are we seeing any of that "we had a lovely caliphate" stuff?
Less so towards the back end of the year, because things really did become quite difficult for its media apparatus. But there are telltale signs, videos that literally use rose-tinted lenses to look at what life was like in some small village in near the Euphrates River. There is a good deal of that.
Now, what do we know about the capacity? We've heard about the idea of virtual control. What about those people who have returned to other countries? Do we know anything at all about whether so-called Islamic State has maintained a capacity to contact them?
Well, that's a very good question. This is something which it has been anticipating for a long time. I mean, there's no two ways about it. Yes, it may be materially weaker than it ever was before. Yes, it may have provoked that intervention that has made it so materially weak. But I think it knew what it was doing. Of course, whether it pays off in the long run is a different question. But there was a period in the summer of 2017 when the Islamic State essentially said, listen, if you want to seek refuge outside of the caliphate, if you like, then you can, that it is permissible. And it said this in a, it was just one line of an article that didn't really deal with the whole seeking refuge question. But still, that parting reference is very, very significant, because essentially the Islamic State was saying that it was permissible to do something that a few years ago, had someone been caught trying to leave the caliphate, then they would have been either locked up in jail or executed for desertion.
Yeah, may I add to that? I think that Islamic State fighters have several options. One of them, which you discussed earlier in the programme, is coming back to Europe if they were foreign fighters who arrived there in the first place. And we're not seeing floods of that. But it's much more difficult for us to track who's going to other places with less secure borders. For example, West Africa, North Africa, Yemen and Somalia, possibly even Indonesia and the Philippines. That's more difficult to tell. But there's also the option of potentially joining Al-Qaeda. And that's not as daft as it sounds, because if you've got the idea of a caliphate, Al-Qaeda too ultimately wants a caliphate. It's simply that it's biding its time. And they are actually putting out material from Al-Qaeda, which looks like they're trying to entice Islamic State fighters.
OK. Charlie, does that correspond with anything that you're seeing in the online traffic and online propaganda?
It does. I'm really glad that Liz brought up this massive rivalry, competition, existential competition between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, because it's something which has been going on for a long time. And the kinds of rhetoric that have been coming out from both sides have been really quite, I mean, striking is a very soft way to put it. But it will be interesting now, if in the months and years to come, to see whether Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, wherever they are, whether they're okay with the fact that, yeah, these people who they're now trying to recruit were once members of a group that itself officially said in an essay about Al-Qaeda back in 2015, that the dogs, and I'm quoting here from this essay, the dogs of Al-Qaeda will burn in a circle of hell lower than that which is reserved for the Crusaders.
Elizabeth Kendall, is there any possibility that there could be an entirely new group using entirely new methods and so on, which could take the place of so-called Islamic State?
I think that is a possibility, especially because the Islamic State, if you really want to boil it down to simple terms, was almost born out of the lack of success of Al-Qaeda. But there are two other options that I'd like to mention for Islamic State fighters. One is there's a concept of a suicide fighter, and that's something that has been really brought to the fore over the last 3 years. If you're under pressure, you can fight to the death. The term in Arabic is in rimasi, someone who dives in, someone who plunges into battle. You're not blowing yourself up immediately, but you're just fighting, not in order to escape, but just in order to die. So with that concept, we might find that actually quite a lot of people do die in Syria and Iraq. But the other option is the recruitment of women. This has the potential to double your fighting force right in situ. And we've seen this as something that Islamic State under duress now has been promoting.
Now, final word from both of you. I mean, it's a hard call, but are we any safer on the streets of London or Paris or Brussels now than we were, say, a year ago or 2 years ago?
It all depends on how good a grasp the security services have over the situation with returnees. I think they have a good grasp, actually, in the UK, that is. And we'll only see in the next few months just how good that is. Now, the reason that I hesitate is because now that the Islamic State has lost this whole utopia thing, the new unique selling point for the Islamic State is actually the ability to inspire, incite, and direct acts of violence outside of the Islamic State. So inflicting pain on the enemies of the Islamic State by itself as an idea, but also by actually directing attacks. And a video released at the end of November drew particular attention to this. It actually said in white writing on a black screen, it said the jihad has entered a new phase. And that is very, very significant for an Islamic State propaganda video to actually concede that, yes, the Islamic State jihad has changed direction now. It's deeply troubling from my perspective, because that just demonstrates where the organisation's new priorities lie.
Elizabeth Kendall.
Are we any safer at home? No, not really. I do actually think that there's an argument that we're less safe at home, in the short term at least, because, of course, if you can't emigrate to the Islamic State, the advice is stay home and do jihad right there. And we should not also lose sight of the fact that Al-Qaeda still also actually aspires to continue to attack the West. Its last major English propaganda magazine to come out had 96 pages in English focused on trying to derail trains with photographs of the European and US rail networks. There's still a lot to be worried about.
That was Elizabeth Kendall summing things up for us. My thanks to her and also to Fiona de Londres, Richard Barrett, David Adesnik and Charlie Winter. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Marie Keyworth. Please let us know what you think about this programme, or indeed the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We read them and we do like hearing from you.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.